About 14 months ago, I got a letter with an invitation asking me to be at Mount Eagle this weekend. And I thought they're really well organized down there. And I told all of my friends back in Canada, have a few, about this wonderful invitation. And then I received a few phone calls from Jim asking me when I was going to be here. And I said, they're really well organized. Finally, I received another phone call from him. He told me to, instead of coming to Huntsville, to go to Nashville. I didn't know where either was. So I said, that's fine. And he said, there's a dear soul there. He's going to meet you. He's a very good friend of yours. He'll know you. You just get off the plane and he'll look after you. His name is George Goodall. And I got off the plane and this dear man was standing there, but I misunderstood what he was doing. I thought he must be the president of the Chamber of Commerce, because he shook hands with everybody that got off that plane, including the girls, and he called them all Cecil. And he ignored me. And the last blow to me was when a fellow come along with a guitar. And George said, welcome to Nashville, Cecil. And the guy says, I'm Johnny Cash. And George says, I thought I'd seen you somewhere before. However, he got me here. And we searched for the interstate highway. And I believe that you are well organized, but I don't know about George. But he is a dear man, and the payoff was, he said, when he finally got me here, he said to the rest of the board, Cecil and I had a wonderful talk. And the only thing that I said all the way out here was we stopped somewhere to have a coffee, and I asked the waitress if I could have some homemade soup. And that was the extent of my talking. I would like to thank the committee for this very pleasurable privilege. And believe me, it's something. I don't know how I can explain it when I go home about Mount Eagle, because just about everything has happened to me. I've had spiritual advice. I've had reason to swear when I tried to get into bed. Apparently the preacher's daughter made my bed. And I hope she does a better job with her own bed, because I don't know who looked after my pajamas, but they weren't easy to get into. But I've just had a great time, and I can't explain it. The wonderful things that have happened, people I've met. And I just don't know how I can tell the people when I get home about Mount Eagle, because there is no way to describe it. You have something here that is different. And I guess it's keeping it simple, as Dr. Bob said. That's probably it. And I guess this morning, some of my good friends said that this is a spiritual talk. And I'd like to thank all of my good friends for the wonderful things they've said to me. Like 60 people have left before breakfast because they didn't want to stay to hear you. And another friend said, well, I'll try and get a tape of your talk, but I'm going to have a snooze this morning. But however, it's nice to see those of you who came along. And I hope that about 2 hours from now that you will be happy that I came. Some of you attended the conference in Toronto, the international conference. And I imagine that some of you noticed the subways, and I imagine that you have them in the United States. The little old train goes underneath. And this happened up in Toronto at the big hotel that you stayed at. There was a drunk came down there one weekend with his wife. He was going to have a little holiday. And when they arrived, he said to her, "Let's go down and have a few drinks." And she knew what his few drinks were like, so she said, "Look, you go on down and drink up and eat up, whatever you're going to do." She said, "I'm going to have a little sleep." So she just fell asleep, and one of these trains went underneath the hotel, and it shook the hotel, and the bed lamp came down and hit her in the face. And it damaged her a bit, and she got a little bit upset. She was one of these gals that still hadn't found Al-Anon. And she phoned up to the office, and she got a hold of the assistant manager, and he came up dressed in all of his finery. And he said, "What seems to be the trouble?" And she told him. And he said, "This is impossible. I've been at this hotel for 26 years, and I've never heard of anything so ridiculous." She said, "Well, look at it. It's there. There's the lamp. There's my face. I'm all black and blue and bleeding." And she said, "I'm not telling you any lies." He said, "Are you sure you and your husband didn't have a fight?" And she said, "I'm positive we didn't have a fight." And he said, "Well, I can't believe it, because this has never happened before." And she said, "Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll put the bed lamp back up where it was, and that train goes underneath here every 20 minutes. And she said, "We'll lie down on the bed, and I'll show you that this can happen." And so they put the bed lamp back up, and she lay down in the bed. He lay down beside her, dressed in all of his finery. And pretty soon, the key turned in the lock, and the door opened, and in came the alcoholic. And he said, "What are you doing in bed with my wife?" And the fella said, "Would you believe I'm waiting for a train?" So I guess I'm not waiting for a train. I better get on with doing what I'm supposed to do. I was one of those people that started drinking when I was 16. That seems to be the age, as Dave said last night. I had joined the Army when I was 16 years of age, not because I wanted to join the Army, but because the Army was someplace to run to. I was in high school. I wasn't getting along that well in high school. It was exam time. And I found out for the first time in my life that I could run from responsibility. And I ran into the Army. And I had my first drink the first night I was in the Army. And I found out that booze was very, very good to me, because it was the answer to my problem. I found out that night that I was as old as the rest of the soldiers. I found out that I knew as much about anything that they wanted to talk about as they did. I found out I could talk more about it, could talk louder about it. But I found out something the next morning, that I was still Cease Cortical. A little boy from a little town, scared, and not knowing what to do in society. I became an instructor in the Army when I was only 16 years of age. And this was good for me in one way, but it was bad in another way. I didn't think there was anything wrong with my drinking, because everybody was drinking. I got kicked out of the Army when I was only 17. I went back to my hometown. I worked in an aircraft factory. I made far too much money, and I drank far too much booze. And I was glad I got kicked out of the army because, once again, I was getting too much responsibility. When I was working in the aircraft factory, I got responsibility far too much for me. Once again, I ran, and I ran back into the army. I told them I'd never been in before, and this time I was a genius. I became an instructor right away. I was recommended for my commission. Thank God, and I know the Canadian Army says this too, I didn't get it. I got kicked out of the army, and I went back once again to my hometown. I started working for a newspaper in the advertising department. And once again, I got that responsibility that I didn't want. And I ran once again, and I ran into the Navy. I went into officer's training in the Navy. And I'd love to stand here this morning and tell you I was an officer in the Canadian Navy, but I wasn't. I got kicked out of officer's training because of alcohol. I was only 18 years of age. And I would have been one of the youngest officers, if not the youngest officer in the Canadian Navy, because you weren't supposed to join it until you were 19. And I liked all of this. I liked it for a conversational bit. I didn't get kicked out of the Navy, but I got kicked out of officer's training. I became a gunner on a merchant ship, and I traveled all over the world, and I drank all over the world. And I knew there was something wrong, but the very fact that I had a big capacity, the fact that I could drink other people under the table, I thought was a big thing. While I was in the Navy, I got married to a little girl back home, and I led her one hell of a life. After the war, I went back home. I started getting jobs. I started losing jobs. I was celebrating the end of the war. I celebrated the beginning of the Korean War. I believe I celebrated the end of that. And I wasn't yet 25 years of age. When I was 25, I went into business for myself along with a partner. I thought that this was maybe the answer. But one morning, and I hope I never forget this, my wife took my two little girls, and she left. I went down to tell my partner what had happened to me, and he kicked me out of the business. And I can remember that morning, I was standing on a corner of this little town back in Canada. And I can remember a fellow coming along and saying, "Where are you going, Cease?" And I can remember saying to him, "I don't care where I go, just get me out of here." And I meant it. I attended my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. I didn't go with anybody. I just heard there was a meeting, and I went in. And I tell this story because I hope that you people never do what was done to me that night. They looked at me like as if I was a kid. They told horrible drinking stories. They were all true, I would imagine. But all it did for me was make me believe that maybe I had another 20 or 30 years to drink to get to where some of these people were. And I walked out of there, and I didn't come back for 2 years. During that time, I lost some more jobs. I spent a lot of money. During the last year that I drank, I became a fighter. I had 17 fights, 17 knockouts, and I lost them all. And I mentioned being a fighter because the last night that I drank, I got in a fight with a man that weighed 265 pounds. And he just about killed me. And I mention this story because I never want to forget it. It was at a smoker back home. And after he knocked me down for the last time onto a cement floor, the people, who many of them are very dear friends of mine today, left me laying on that floor. Stepped over me because they didn't care, because I'd become a drunken bum. The next day, I went to a doctor. And I went to a doctor because I was sitting in the place that I usually drank, and I had some money. And back there at that time, you could buy as much beer as could fit on a table. And I used to drink at this place because I was a high-class bum, and I used to look down at those low-class bums. And this night I sat at a table all by myself with a table full of beer, and none of those low-class bums came to drink with me. I went and tried to eat, and I couldn't. And so I phoned a doctor. And he put me into hospital. I was 27 years old. Next morning, gave me some intravenous, and he kept me in hospital for about 5 days. And finally, he sat down and talked to me. And he said, "Cease, there is nothing I can do for you other than do what I've already done. I have built you up physically, and now the rest is up to you." And I tell this story because I hear so many people condemn doctors. Because this doctor said to me, "Cece," he said, "I was in the army with you, and you were an alcoholic at that time. And you haven't gotten any better, you're worse." And I said, "Okay, what am I going to do?" And he said, "I would suggest that you join Alcoholics Anonymous." And he didn't let me go out of that hospital to join Alcoholics Anonymous. He brought Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And I'll never forget the two guys that came to see me. One of them was the sloppiest drunk, I'm sure, in all of Canada. And he was a drinking buddy of mine. But he was dressed up. He had a nice suit on. He had a silk shirt and a bow tie. His hair was combed. He was clean. And his shoes were shined. And he didn't have to say anything because I knew that something had happened to Bill. The other guy was a guy that I'd been in the service with. And he had received 5 years in a penitentiary for robbery with violence. And he had found Alcoholics Anonymous in a penitentiary. And he, too, came to see me. And these two guys talked to me. And then they took me out of hospital. And I hope I never forget what I looked like when I got out of that hospital. I had no buttons on my shirt because of the fight I'd been in. My wife, who had come back to me, hadn't come to see me in hospital. I didn't have any shaving gear in the hospital. I didn't have any money to have a shave, but thank God somebody shaved me. I was all black and blue from the beating I'd taken. And I went out and met you wonderful people. And I hope I never forget that morning. It was January the 16th, 1952. And those guys started to arrive into this little cafe where they had this emergency meeting. And there were only about 8 of them at that time in my hometown. And they all came. And they didn't ask me who I was or what I was, or how much money I had, or what was wrong with my shirt. They just said, "Cease, do you want to stop drinking? We can help you." And that night they took me to a meeting, and it was a Saturday night. And they took my wife with me. And I didn't believe what I saw, I really didn't. They were laughing, and they were enjoying themselves. And I didn't believe that they weren't drinking. I said, some of them are having a little smash here somewhere. After the social, the beginning of the night, they had a social, then they had a meeting. And I can remember about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, some of those old-timers sitting down and talking to me. And they said, "Cease, there are no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. But they said there's a meeting at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning and you must be there." And I'm glad they talked to me like this. Because this was the type of language that I needed. And it scares me sometimes when I hear people say, "Well, come and have a look. Don't worry about a thing." And they fail to tell you about the program. Because these people took charge of me. And I went to the meeting the next morning. And I went to the meeting on the Monday night. And I went to the meeting on the Thursday night. And I've never stopped going. Because they told me that's what I should do if I wanted to stay sober. And I enjoyed what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, the laughter, the fellowship. I enjoyed the pats on the back that I got from the people downtown that knew me, found out I had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. I enjoyed the pats on the back I got from the rest of the group because I was such a terrific young fellow and so active. I went to all of the roundups. I did everything I was supposed to do. And I liked all of these things. But finally, they stopped patting me on the back. The people around that were close to me took it for granted that I was sober. And I was one of these people that came into Alcoholics Anonymous and took the first part of that first step. And the second part of that 12th step, and that's what I tried to do. Admit that I was powerless over alcohol and tried to sober up the whole wide world. And some people call these people two-steppers. But if you figure it out, a half and a third is not two. So I wasn't even a two-stepper. And after I'd been in a little while longer, suddenly a void came into my life. The fellowship wasn't enough. The running to conferences and listening to speakers wasn't enough. I needed something more. And some of us decided to start to look at those steps. And I took a look at that step one. And it says, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. You know, so many of us look at the first part of step one. And we don't look at the second part of step one about the unmanageability of our lives. And I don't care whether you're an Alateen, Al-Anon, or Alcoholics Anonymous. We think this was something that happened while we were drinking. I guarantee that anybody, you give them enough of that booze, and they will have an unmanageable life. But what about in between drinks? What about after we've stopped drinking? What about after we've come to Alateen, Al-Anon, or Alcoholics Anonymous? What about it then? My life became more unmanageable after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't have any excuse for it. At least when you're drinking, you've got an excuse. I was a big spender. It didn't matter whose money I was spending, I was a big spender. After I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I owed $6,200 when I came on the program. At that time, that was a lot of money. And I didn't owe it for a Chesterfield, a car, a house, or something. I just owed it. And I can remember my boss bailing me out to the bank. And I can remember signing a paper that I would never charge anything again. And I can remember 3 years later, he bailed me out again, not for $6,200, but for a little bit more. And I signed the paper again, because I had an unmanageable life still. And I was trying to buy my way still back into society the way I had done when I was drinking. I was trying to buy the love of my family by buying them things that they didn't need instead of giving them myself. And I looked at that step two, and it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I thought, this must be wrong. I was never in a mental hospital, so how could I be restored to sanity? But then I thought, and some of my older members in my group helped me to think about the insane things that I did while I was sober. And you know, one time, talking about insanity, I was unemployed, and I went to Saskatoon to get a big job. I never ever got a little job. Saskatoon is about 100 miles from my hometown, and I went down there to have an interview with a chewing gum company. This was a big job. And I went to one hotel, and the interview was at another hotel, and I never did get to have the interview. I got drunk for 3 days. I went back home. My good little wife said, "How was the interview?" I said, "I just have to wait for a letter. I'm getting that big job, I'm sure." Now, that's not too bad, telling that story. We've all told little lies like that. But when you start going to the mailbox every morning... looking for that letter... and coming back in and telling your wife, "I just can't figure out why they haven't written me. They didn't even know who I was, and they didn't know that I existed." And then I doubted this little bit can restore me to sanity. And then it says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand it. I was one of these people that just couldn't make a decision. I had a difficult time with decisions. And I know that many of you people have the same problems. But a dear old timer come to me and he said, "Cease, you've admitted that your life is unmanageable. Take step two and take, you've found a manager." And then he said, "Take step three and turn your will and your life over to the care of this manager. Keep it that simple, and I guarantee it will work." And I tried it. And then it came to that step four. And it said, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And I went to some of those dear old timers. And I said to them, "How do you take this step four?" And they said, "Don't worry about that. You know, easy does it. Easy does it, all right. They almost killed me." And I tell this because I hope nobody ever does that to anybody. Whether you're in Alateen Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon. Because that step four is so important. It says, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I run a fairly successful business today. And if I was to say to my staff before I left home, "I want an inventory taken of my stock, and I'm in the fur business, and I was to go home, and I would say, where is the inventory?" And they would say, "Well, I think we have so many of this and so many of that and so many of this." Well, I'm a very compassionate guy, but I guarantee they wouldn't be working there very long. And so an inventory to me today means where you write it down. And I know in this area there's no use talking about this because you've all taken your step four, whether you belong to Al-Anon, Al-Ateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous. But there are some areas where they haven't taken it. And I'm going to pretend I'm talking to those areas. Because I know that every time I've gone on a 12-step call where somebody has had a slip, I talked to them about step 4 and step 5, and they haven't taken it. And if some of you are having a difficult time with step 4, we'll just take for granted you are, I'll give you a little easy way to take it. Find somebody that you dislike, and that's not too difficult, no matter what program we're on. And start writing down what you dislike about them. And don't be easy on them. Everything that you dislike about them. And write it down and write it real hard. Break the nib of the pen, do anything you want. And then when you're all finished, put your own name up top. Because I guarantee what people dislike in other people is what is wrong with themselves. And if you don't believe that it works, if you want to argue with it, go ahead, but argue after you have done it. That is the time to argue. And then it goes on to that wonderful step 5. And you know, the only thing that I believe is wrong, or the only thing that I believe is difficult about step 5, is step 4. I believe that anybody that will take a decent step 4, a proper step 4, will want to take step 5. We have a dear little minister back home that explains it this way. He said, step 4 is like having a boil. And when you go to take your step 5, it's like having that boil lanced. And you release all of that pressure. And I believe this. And that step 4, that step 5, we've already taken 2/3 of it. We've admitted to ourselves and to God. And now all we have to do is go and rap off to somebody else, another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. And you're going to find people, when you're asking about step 5, you're going to find people that say, take it easy. These aren't my own thoughts. I found this in the book that was written for us. This is where I found this. So don't think this is some Yahoo bit of stuff that I brought from Canada. This is something that I found in the book. And it says, when in doubt, take it now. And I believe this. But then it goes on to that wonderful step 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Really, if we look at it, we haven't done very much. We've admitted we have an unmanageable life. We've gone on to step 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We've made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we've understood Him. We've gone on to step 4, made this searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We've gone and talked to somebody else. And now we're standing there with that inventory. We know how good we are or how bad we are. And it says we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. What does it say in the 12 by 12? It says this is the step that separates the men from the boys. Are we entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character? Somebody said to me not too long ago, if I did that, I'd be a saint. Well, I said, do it and try to be a saint. I haven't met any. Maybe you'll be the first one. It'd be nice to have a saint in the group. But I think the majority of us are afraid of becoming too good too fast. I think this is so. And we expect too much. We expect things to happen by not doing anything to make them happen. You know, we're just like a little drunk that was sitting in a bar one day and his buddy walked in and he said, what's the matter, Charlie? Charlie said, well, 2 months ago, he said, my uncle died. He left me $100,000. So his buddy said, well, I'm sorry to hear that. He said, that's not all, he said. Last month, my aunt died. She left me $80,000. Well, he said, no, don't be so down in the dumps. After all, you got $180,000. He said they were probably old people anyway. What are you looking so glum about? He said, this month, nothing yet. And I think this is us. We sit there and say, nothing has happened. Nothing is happening to us. Look at all those other people having such a good time in Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and Alateen, and nothing is happening to us. I don't think it will, unless we make it happen. And then it goes on to that wonderful step 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Those founders of ours were pretty cagey people. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. They didn't say, they didn't write it down, prayed to God to remove our shortcomings, but that's what they meant. And the only way that I can be humble, the only way that I can pray to God in this step, is by getting down on my knees. And you know, I was one of these people that used to tell the newcomer, or the old-timer, anybody, about praying. And I used to tell them, pray when you're driving your automobile. Pray when you're lying in bed. Pray when you're riding horseback. Pray when you're doing anything. But I never, ever told anybody to pray by getting down on their knees, because I hadn't done it myself. And I can remember when Jim and Bill and I were delegates in New York. And we had a dear friend who's passed on now by the name of Shy Walker. And I can remember Shy talking one night, and he told a story about when he came out of penitentiary. And he told how they told him to pray each morning and each night. And he told how he had these big high-top boots. And he told how he just couldn't get down on his knees. And then he said one morning, by mistake, the night before, he had kicked the high-top boots underneath the bed. And he said the next morning, when he got down to get the high-top boots out, he decided to say a few words. He decided to pray. Then he said he used to kick the boots under the bed every night so that he could pray the next morning down on his knees. And some of you may laugh. Some of you may think this is a difficult way. But I didn't have high-top boots, but it worked with shoes because I tried it. And if any of you are having a difficult time tonight, and if you want to pray down on your knees, try it. It works. To humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And then it comes to that wonderful step 8 where we have to make another list. And it says, made a list of all the people we have harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And how many times do you hear people say, I made a mental list? This is not what it asks us to do. I am sure that if some of you ladies went to shop and you made a mental list, you would either come home with things you didn't want or you wouldn't come home with the complete list of the things you wanted. And this is what it means by making a list to me. They say keep it simple. And it says made a list of all the people we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And I'm sure that any one of us, if I was to say, make a list of those chairs, you would get a pencil and a paper and make the list. But when it says, made a list of all the people we have harmed, many of us fail to get the pencil and the paper. And I think that's probably the toughest part, is getting the pencil and the paper and starting to write. And some people say, well, I can't make those amends. This is not what it asks us to do in step 8. It says, made a list of all the people we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them. Mind you, it traps us in step 9. But that's not the object of the exercise in step 8. Because step 9 says, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. When I went out to make these amends, I don't think I deserve any credit for paying back all of the money that I owed. I had a job back in Canada. When you owe money, they don't worry about you paying it or about you worrying about it. They worry about it. And they make sure that you pay it back if you have a job. So I don't deserve any credit for paying all of that dough back, because they made sure that I paid it back. Every afternoon at 4 o'clock, I knew who was on the phone. 5 o'clock, I knew who was there too. And I knew what the sheriff wanted when he'd come see me. They wanted some of the money that I owed to some of the people. So I can't say that I made these amends. I made them because they insisted that I make them. But the amends that I had the difficult time making were the ones that I had to go out and say I was sorry. I had to go out and say I was sorry to somebody who didn't know that I had hurt them. Somebody that I had assassinated their character. And this was one of my greatest attributes to society, was going around assassinating people's character. I used to tell about what horrible people other people were so that I could be a big person. And I said some horrible things about many, many people. And this wasn't easy to do, but I had to do it. I don't know whether or not you have to do it, but I had to do it if I wanted to stay sober. And I wanted to stay comfortably sober. And so I had to do it. And you know, the toughest amend that I had to make was a real small one, but it was a real big one. One night I was sitting in a high-class beer parlor back home. I was the only one in the place. I was running a punch board. If any of you people know what that is, you probably don't down here. It's, we buy them from the United States. And business wasn't so good. And a couple of fellas came in, and they wanted to buy me a beer, and I went along with them. And then they suggested that we go to a hockey game. And I told them I'd left my wallet at home and I couldn't go. So they said, well, come along, we'll look after you. So they got a case, a 12-pack of beer. And they put me in the back seat with the beer. And they got in the front seat. When we got out to go to the hockey game, they said, lock the back door, Cease. And I just couldn't seem to get that door locked. And I lost them in the crowd, and I went back, and I stole the beer. I went down to the place that I drank, this Army and Navy Veterans of Canada Club, and somebody stole it from me. And I was going to clean the place out. I ranted and raved, you know, here I am, an old veteran of Canada. You come in here to a bunch of thieves, steal your beer. And after I stopped drinking, I met these two fellas that I stole the beer from every time I came around a corner. And not only that, one day they told me, you remember the night we went to the hockey game, Cease? And I said, yes. And they said, somebody stole a case of beer that night. And I said, imagine that. A little town like the size of Prince Albert, and you can't even leave something in your car. This is what I told them. And then one of these fellows came in one day and he borrowed $10 from me. One night my wife and I were coming from a drive-in theater and I went in a cafe to get some cigarettes for her. And these two fellas were sitting in there, and they grinned at me and said, "Hi, Cease." And this one guy said, "Here's that $10, Zoe." And I said, "How much is a case of beer?" And he said, "What do you want for the case of beer? You stop drinking." And I said, "Well, just how much is a case of beer, you know?" I went right to the point when I made these amends. I didn't go around the bush. And he wouldn't tell me. So I put down $3. I told him what I'd done. And then they wouldn't believe me. But I left the $3 and went out of there. Now you may say, "Well, it's only $3. But let's look at it. Here were two fellas that trusted me. They were friends. I not only had to admit that I owed them $3 for a case of beer, I had to admit that I stole their beer. And a $3 score is really not a big score if any of you people are thieves, you know? But this is what I had to do. And they still grin at me, but I don't care anymore. I grin back. And these are the things that I had to do. There were many things like this that I had to do to get comfortable within me. And if any of you are having people grin at you as you come around corners, I would suggest that you make the amend. Because it's much nicer to walk down the main street, believe me, and grin back when they grin. And I think this is what it means. And I wonder why they put them in this way. These 9 steps. Because I think we are very self-centered people. And I didn't figure this out. I found it in the book. And I find that the people that are associated with us, with the alcoholic, become self-centered people. They have to survive. And they too need this program. And I wonder why they started it at step 1 and they worked up to step 9. The way they did. I think that if it's put that way, because each and every step, as we take them in sequence, whittles a little bit more of that self-centeredness off us and whittles us down to size and puts us to where we're supposed to be. And then it came to that wonderful 10th step. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And this step is very, very, very dear to me. Because you see, after I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years, and I was doing real good, so I thought. But I became real greedy for material things. I was working for the wealthiest man in my city, and I wanted to be the wealthiest man in my city. I wanted him to be second. And I started out to try to get these material things. And I got some of them. But in trying to get these things, I became poor once again spiritually. I didn't quit going to AA. I went to AA every week. I went to roundups. But I wasn't the same in there. And one day my boss and I went into the office. I was managing a big ladies' wear store. And when I came out of the office, I didn't have a job. I got fired. I got fired not because of something I had done as far as the company was concerned. I got fired because of my attitude. Because once again, I had become a big wheel. And it seemed that they didn't want me around that company. And I can remember, and the reason I tell this story is because I hope this doesn't happen to any one of you. Whether you're an Alateen, Al-Anon, or Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I became very complacent, you see. And I can remember I have a little cousin. And she too, and this one's legitimate.
Hey, that's funny, Bill. I was trying to be serious. She came from the west coast of Canada. She came to visit. And she must have been a little bit confused because she's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous as well. And I'd written her the fall before and I told her about the big job that I just turned down. And she arrived in my hometown and I was unemployed. And Fern, I believe, was sent to Prince Albert at that time because she was able to talk to me. And I can remember I was leaving for a roundup at Flin Flon. Now, there's some of the people here who were in Winnipeg that don't call it Flin Flon, but it is Flin Flon. And don't laugh at the name because I've heard some names down here that aren't really the greatest names either. But I was leaving for this conference, and I got a brand new suit, and I went down to my little cousin, and I stood up in front of her, and in my big egotistical way, I said, "Well, kid, how do I look?" And she said just a few simple words. And I hope that they'll help somebody as much as they helped me. Because she said, "You look real good on the outside, Cease, but how are you really on the inside?" And I took those words with me and I went away 600 miles. And another dear old man who passed away not too long ago, he was 82 years old when he died, he had come to go to the roundup with me. He had driven many miles because he knew I was in trouble. And he didn't talk on this trip. He let me drive the car, and he let me think. And I took a look at Cease, as it tells you to do in that step 10, and I found out that old Cease wasn't as good a shape as he thought he was. I went into Winnipeg, Manitoba. I got a hotel room. I stayed there for 2 days. I was trying to figure out my future, but first of all, I wanted to figure out Cease. And I went back to Prince Albert, and I got back into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you might say, "Well, that's funny, I never was away," and I wasn't. But I was away as far as I was concerned. I started doing the things that I was supposed to do. I started going back to institutions and doing service work. I stopped being a wheel, and I came back into Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for a wonderful bunch of people, I didn't get drunk. And then it comes to that wonderful step 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him. Praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. If you look in the 12 by 12, it talks about complacency. It talks about appreciation. But meditation and prayer, isn't it wonderful that we've learned how to do these things through taking these steps in sequence? That we can pray and we can meditate. And that we can improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him. You know, last spring I was a trustee nominee for Western Canada. And I can remember the day of the election. And I'm not going to say that I didn't care whether I was a trustee or not. I wanted to be a trustee. And I can remember the morning of the election in New York. And I was away out in Western Canada. And I can remember saying a prayer. And the prayer went something like this. That I wanted to be able to handle a job if it was given to me. And also that I wanted to be able to accept it if it wasn't given to me. And I can remember getting the phone call telling me that I wasn't a trustee. And I got in my car and I went for a drive. And I can remember when I came back, Tom Breen was on the phone. And Tom knows me pretty well. And he said, "You've been out for a car ride, haven't you, buddy?" And I said, "Yes." But I was able to accept that through the 11th step of this program. And I was able to do other things that maybe I have another purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous besides being a trustee. I was able to accept the fact that maybe I wasn't ready to be a trustee. And this is what the 11th step has taught me. And then it goes to that 12th and wonderful step, having had a spiritual awakening. As the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many people say, "How do you get this spiritual awakening?" It tells us, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And I would believe it's taking them in sequence, the way that it's laid down in the book. And when we talk about the spiritual experience, to me that's all it is a personality change. I like to think of the story of the great actor. And you've all heard it probably, about the great actor that was asked to say the 23rd Psalm at some big do that he was going to. And he practiced it in front of a mirror. And he practiced it on a tape recorder. And he got it down absolutely perfect. And he went to his church the Sunday morning before this big thing was supposed to happen. And his minister said the 23rd Psalm. And finally the big night arrived and he got up in front of this microphone and he said the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." And when he was finished, he got a standing ovation. And he went back up to the microphone and he asked the people to sit down. And he said, "I have a minister friend in the audience and I would like him to come up here and say the 23rd Psalm." And his minister friend came up and he said it from the heart, the way it's supposed to be said. And when he was finished, there was no standing ovation. There was tears in a lot of eyes. And the actor once again went up to the microphone and he said, "You see, the difference is that I know the sheep, but he knows the shepherd." And I hope we leave this conference feeling this way. And it goes on to the second part of that step. And it says, we tried to carry this message to the alcoholic that still suffers. How many of us really try to carry out our responsibility? That's all it asks us to do, is to try. It doesn't tell us that every time we go on a 12-step call that it's going to be successful. I can guarantee you that it will be successful if you go, because you will stay the way you're supposed to stay. If you're a drunk, you will stay sober. I can guarantee it, if you do what you're supposed to do. And yet so many of us forget who we are and what we are and where we came from. And I hope you never forget this, because I did. And I became a big wheel. And I hope that you can remember that this is our responsibility, to try to carry the message. And when Bill and Jim and I were privileged to be delegates, we had another fellow from your area by the name of Rufus Smith. And I can remember I told a story at the conference, and the next year, dear old Rufus stood up and he said, "My name is Rufus Smith and I'm from Tennessee." And he said, "I would like Cease to tell a story that he told last year." But he said, "I would like to see Cease to tell his story real slow. Because not only," he said, "do I talk slow, I hear slow." And I wish that Rufus was here this morning. Because I've told this story so many, many times. And no doubt you people have heard it too, because Rufus has probably told it to you. I know that Bill has told it. But it's my story and I'm going to tell it. And it's a story about a young member in Alcoholics Anonymous who decided that he was going to quit. And he went to one of the older members and he said, I'm going to quit. And the older member said, well, why are you going to quit? And he said, well, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me that I didn't have to do anything. They told me there were no dues or there were no fees. And he said, now they want money for General Service Office. They want money for the State Assembly. They're having a birthday party. They want me to go to penitentiaries and do 12-step work. They want me to go to hospitals. And he said, and I'm getting sick and tired of it. And I'm going to quit. And the old member sat back for a while, and then in his easy-does-it way, he said, you know, son, I don't blame you a bit. Because he said, your story reminds me of the story of my life. But he said, when we were very young, my wife and I were blessed with a bouncing baby boy. And he said, somebody told me that three could live as cheap as two. But the moment that child was born, he started to cost me money. I had to take the child home. The mother had to stay in the hospital. I had to hire people to look after the child at home and to look after the mother in hospital. Finally, the mother came home, and every time I went downtown, I had to buy something for that boy. Finally, he started to walk around. I had to buy a tricycle. Finally, he went into public school. A tricycle wasn't big enough. He had to have a bicycle. He had to have sporting goods clothes. He had to have extra money to go away to summer camp. Finally, he said he went into high school, and there he really started to cost me money. Extra money to take the girls out. The bicycle was no good. I had to have a motorcycle. The motorcycle wasn't big enough. He had to get an old car. He wanted extra money to go away to summer camps. And he said, I was like you. I was getting sick and tired of it. And I felt like quitting. But then he said, in the final year of high school, that boy of ours died. And he hasn't cost us a penny since. I tell that story because I think that it's so significant to this wonderful program. That we have so much and so much opportunity in Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and Al-Ateen to go out and talk to other people and let them enjoy what we are enjoying today and during this wonderful weekend that we've had at Mount Eagle. And then it goes on. And it talks about practicing these principles in all our affairs. I wonder when we're driving home today, I wonder how we will be. Will we be as nice a people as we have been since Thursday night? I wonder when we get home, I wonder when we get back to work, will we be like we were at Mount Eagle? And I believe this is what it means when it says practice these principles in all our affairs. And I also believe another thing, that the problems that we're having with youth today, I believe that if we could tell them that maybe they shouldn't do these things, if we were not doing them ourselves, maybe it would be more effective. And it reminds me of the story of the great Vincent Peale. And you all, people have all heard him, seen him on television, where he talks about serenity. And one time him and the great Eddie Rickenbacker, they were asked to do a show out in Hollywood. And they got there at 3:30, they were supposed to be there. The other people weren't there. Finally, Vincent Peale noticed that the cameraman came, somebody else came, but he sort of lost his cool, as they say today. That serenity that he talks about, he completely lost it. And he went up to the producer and he said, look, you told me to be here at 3:30 and I was here. I have another appointment at 5 o'clock. Eddie Rickenbacker's also a very busy man. And he ranted and he raved. And finally looked over, and here's dear old Eddie Rickenback, who he's found an old rocking chair, and he's sitting underneath a tree. And he walked over to him, and he said, "How can you do this? We were supposed to be here at 3:30. We were here. The other people weren't here." He said, "I imagine you have other appointments like I have." And he said, "You sit there rocking underneath a tree." He said, "What's wrong with you?" And Eddie Rickenbacker said, "I am just trying to practice what you preach." And I think this is something that we should remember when we are telling other people about this program. And I know that we can't do it the way that we're supposed to do it, but we can try. And this is the way that I look at Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I'm going to leave here this afternoon, and I don't know what is going to happen. Because I have had such a tremendous weekend, emotionally and spiritually. It's been just a fantastic thing. I can't describe it. And I'm going away from here with whole pailfuls of AA to take back to Canada. And I'm going back with many memories, many things to tell the people. And I want to thank you people for having me here. Because if somebody had told me 17 years ago that one day I would be asked to come all the way to Mount Eagle to speak at your Sunday morning roundup, I wouldn't have believed. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity. And I want to thank each and every one of you. And just outside of Omaha, Nebraska, there's a little place called Boys Town. And as you drive up to this little place, you see a statue. And on this statue is one little boy carrying another little boy. And you can tell by the way that he is stooped over, by the sweat on his brow, that he is having a very difficult time. But underneath are words something to this effect: "No, Lord, he is not heavy.